Good morning, Allison.
Good morning. Full disclosure, I have a toddler home with me who's sick, so we're going to see how well we can do this. There's a small chance there will be a meltdown and we'll have to cut this short, but I'm going to try real hard to make this work because I know we didn't do this last week. So lovely to see you guys. Want to give you guys an update on the COVID-19 situation. Nationwide cases are dropping rapidly, which is really hopeful. We're actually seeing it in all regions of the country at this point. Hospitalizations are just starting to decrease nationwide. They're down about 27%, which as they're a lagging indicator. And the unfortunately, deaths, which are the latest lagging indicator, are not yet decreasing. We're actually still seeing 2,500 Americans dying every day due to COVID-19. So it's still a very serious situation, but case counts are dropping. And subsequently after that, we tend to see hospitalizations and deaths follow. So we're moving in the right direction nationwide, which is very hopeful after the difficult couple of months that we've had. In Washington's cases are starting to drop as well. So cases statewide are down 37%. The areas that were hit first are dropping first. So the large cities, King County, Snohomish County are seeing the most rapid drop off. The Olympic Peninsula is starting to plateau and seeing the beginning of a drop, but we haven't seen a significant drop yet. And then the east side of the mountains is still rising, largely due to both their delayed Delta peak and also just the limited COVID-19 precautions that you see on the east side of the mountains. In Jefferson County, we are at 2,753 cases as of today. Our case rate is down slightly to 1,069 per 100,000. So we're nearly below 1,000, but we have largely seen a plateau and the beginning of a drop. This weekend, we only added 42 cases, which is about half of what we've been adding in recent weekends. So we're hopeful that that is the beginning of the decrease in cases that we anticipate. We have 3 of our citizens currently hospitalized, and we have lost 23 of our citizens due to COVID-19. In Clallam County, our case rates are also starting to decrease, but not seeing a rapid decrease yet. The case rate there is 1,601 per 100,000, and we've lost 95 of our citizens to COVID-19. Kitsap County is still relatively high, though they're starting to see their cases come down too. They're at 1,700 cases per 100,000 right now. So full disclosure, my daughter is climbing on the thing where this video is. So yeah, you can see my arms holding it steady.
Dr. Berry, this is a very family-friendly meeting. So please do not let it stop you. This is the reality we're all living in right now. Please don't be self-conscious about it.
For better or worse, many of us have been working from home with toddlers in the last couple of years. So I know many folks know how this goes. What we are seeing in our recent cases is really we're seeing a marked difference in hospitalization between folks who are vaccinated and not vaccinated. The good news that we're seeing is for those who are fully vaccinated, we are seeing rates of hospitalization and death that are similar to the flu. So we have finally reached that point that so many folks have talked about since the very beginning. There has been a contingent who has said COVID-19 is about as dangerous as the flu. That has never been true before, but with vaccination, it now is. So we are, which is not nothing. You know, the flu is still a very serious virus. It still hospitalizes many Americans every year and unfortunately kills many Americans every year. But it is much, much safer than COVID-19. And now with full vaccination, we're seeing rates of hospitalizations that are quite similar, even in those over 65. So that's really hopeful. Unfortunately, for those who are not vaccinated, we do not see that similar reduction in severity. So it's still a very, very serious disease for those who are not vaccinated. So with that, I'm happy to start with questions from our commissioners. And then I know we have quite a few questions from the public today, which I will do my very best to get through before we lose the patience of our toddler friend.
I would defer any time that I might consume with questions to that list. I read that list of questions. It's a big one and there's lots of good questions on it. So.
You want to get on my legs? Yeah, you can get on my legs.
There are great questions on the list. I just was wondering before you get to it, Dr. Berry, if you can go into a little bit the vaccine requirement for indoor dining in restaurants. You know, I know there's been lots of news and a lot of confusion it looks like you've added a few more metrics for as criteria. And I'm just wondering if you can go into where are we in Jefferson County, maybe compared to Clallam County in, for, you know, this March 11 or earlier or later date.
Sure, yes. So we can talk a bit about that. So one of the things we've talked about on this forum before is kind of when is it safe to revoke the proof of vaccination requirement? And we had settled on, with the Omicron wave, likely a higher case threshold of 200 cases per 100,000, which is a little bit above what we were using before of 75. The reason for that is that COVID-19 with the Omicron wave case for case is leading to less hospitalization and death. But still, when you see a massive amount of cases, you see, unfortunately, a massive surge in hospitalization and death. So we set that threshold of 200 cases per 100,000. When I met with the restaurant owners who were suing me in Clallam County, we did have a good meeting to kind of talk about their concerns and their challenges. And one of the salient points that they brought up is that for many people, a case threshold feels really opaque. It's hard to believe that we're ever going to hit that case threshold. And so for some of them, they felt like we're just never going to hit that. And that offered me the opportunity to really walk them through the modeling that we have, which is that we expect to be below that case threshold by mid-March. So looking at the modeling we're seeing out of University of Washington, that's really when we expect to be below that case threshold as a region. Now, it's possible that Jefferson County will actually be there sooner, given that we tend to have much lower case rates than Clallam County because of all the work we're doing. And so if we get there sooner, if we get below 200 cases per 100,000 before that time period, then we can give a little guess popping in. Then we can see our order revoked actually faster than the March 11th date that we anticipate will be there in Clallam County. One thing that we did, though, was because we were really picking a date when we expect to be below that threshold for Clallam, we wanted to make sure there was a safeguard in place in case that didn't come to pass, in case the modeling didn't turn out to be true and our hospital systems were still overwhelmed. We didn't want to do anything that was unsafe. And so we put kind of a safeguard in there that if the hospital system, if this was all entirely untrue, the modeling was completely wrong, and the hospitals were actively overwhelmed, we wouldn't revoke the order then. But that's just kind of a safeguard since we were moving more towards a date than a case threshold. Now, that agreement does not technically apply to Jefferson County, but I do think that Jefferson County will be at that rate before March 11th, or at least by March 11th. So most likely, we're going to plan on revoking the order for both counties around that same time. I think it's helpful for our business owners to have some clarity around how long this order is going to last so that they can plan their business operations. They can plan their hiring and their food ordering and all those kind of things. And I do really think that by mid-March, we're going to be in a safe place to do that. I wouldn't revoke the order if I didn't think it was safe to do so. But I do think we will be there then.
Thank you. That's very clarifying. And just to make sure I understand. So on March 12th in Clallam County, if they're not below 200 cases per 100,000, but are below, 70% ICU beds, 60%?
I think 90, but yes.
Oh, 90%, sorry. Do you anticipate revoking the order, or is that like a hard line?
Yeah, it will. We will revoke the order March 12th, even if we're above 200 cases per 100,000, if the hospital system's functioning well. So say we're at 250, then we'll go ahead and revoke it anyway.
And then in Jefferson County, you'll plan on using the metrics of 200 and hospital capacity.
Still planning to stick with that. Now, as we get closer to that date, if we see that really cases are moving down faster, of course we could revoke it sooner, but I think it makes sense for our region to move together. So roughly, I think we should plan on March 11th too, if not sooner, depending on our case rates.
Great, thanks for diving into that.
No worry, very reasonable. And we had planned on for those who are listening, we had planned on putting out some messaging on this, but the paper has been following it very closely. So they put it out a little bit before our messaging could come out. I apologize about that. But we will be doing more communications with our restaurant owners in the next week to help them understand kind of the nitty gritty of these details.
Could I just ask a quick follow-up? Some restaurants may choose to retain a policy for themselves of continuing to require proof of vaccination, correct?
Absolutely. So restaurants can always do a more stringent option. So when we revoke the order countywide, that just means that restaurants don't have to do it. But if there are restaurants that choose to for their own safety, for the safety of their staff, for their clients, that's totally reasonable. In fact, right now there are some restaurants in King County that are more stringent than the King County order. They've decided to say that you can't come in unless you're boosted. And that's an option. You can do that. And so if any of our local restaurants want to have a more stringent order, that's totally within their rights to do even now.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions from the commissioners before I move on to KPTZ? Okay. So yeah, we had 20 questions today. And so I'll move through them my very best. And I know Willie Benz, who can't be with us today, wanted me to speak a little bit about the mass distribution as well. So I'll make sure and save a little time for that. One of the questions from a listener said, I do not feel eating outside at a restaurant is safe as it might be given the highly contagious rate of Omicron and the high number of cases locally. My husband does not agree with me. We are older people with other health conditions. What is your opinion? And I would say, you know, outdoor dining actually is pretty safe right now. Outdoor activities generally is safe. We've not seen Omicron spreading outdoors. So we do think that it is safe to go ahead and do that. The one caveat I would say is you do want it to be truly outdoor dining. Sometimes I've seen some restaurants build outdoor facilities that just look like indoor that has been moved outside that have kind of four walls around them and have no air movement. That would be less safe. But if you're actually outside on a patio with some heat lamps over you, that kind of thing, that's very safe. So very reasonable to patronize our local restaurants that way. And I know many of our restaurants have gotten really creative with making those spaces actually pretty warm. So it is a good option for folks who want to stay safe, but still enjoy eating out. And of course, you can still enjoy takeout. Some of our restaurants are takeout only right now, and that's a good way to support them as well. So this question was about reinfection rates. So they were wondering about statistics around rates of reinfection to help people understand the risk, even if you've had COVID-19 before. And we don't have a breakdown of reinfections for Jefferson County. It's a pretty difficult number to get. Couple reasons for that. One is that most of our reinfections came in the midst of this massive surge. So our ability to do that kind of nitty-gritty data parsing has been a little bit limited because of just the surge of case demand. But also we know that currently many of our cases are not getting counted. So if you take a home antigen test and you don't call us about it, we don't know. So we know that our reinfection rates are going to be an underestimate. In Washington State, they did just put out a new reinfection report in the last couple of weeks. So you can find the Washington State Department of Health website. If you go to the state DOH dashboard, there's a whole bunch of reports in the report section that you can click through. But one of them is about reinfections. So what we know with Omicron is reinfections are much, much more likely than they were with Delta. In fact, you're 16 times more likely to get reinfected with Omicron than you were when the Delta virus was predominant in our region. The other thing that we know is in Washington State as a whole, we have had 27,000 documented reinfections just in the last, just since January. And that's just the ones we know about, which is generally gonna mean you got a PCR. Because most antigen tests are not counted at the state level. So we know that it's really high in our region. We've seen outbreaks among folks who got reinfected. So our first wrestling outbreak with Omicron involved quite a few reinfections. You can dramatically reduce your risk of getting reinfected if you get vaccinated after you survive your infection. So we're always really grateful when those in our community have gotten through their infection and recovered, but know that it does not provide 100% immunity from subsequent infection. In the UK, where they've had some of the largest data sets about Omicron, they found that prior infection from COVID-19 alone without a subsequent vaccination only provides about 20% protection against subsequent infections. It's not very good. So you do want to go ahead and get vaccinated. That's going to dramatically reduce your risk of getting COVID-19. It's a very safe vaccine. There's been some common misconceptions both around protection and also around concern that the vaccine wouldn't be safe if you have already had COVID-19. That's not true. It's very, very safe. Basically, what you can consider your prior infection as is about consistent with one dose of the vaccine. So if you've had an infection, you go on to get a two-dose series of the mRNA vaccine, you're going to be pretty well protected. You can, of course, also go ahead and get your booster, and then you'll be very well protected. All right, couple other questions. But yes, besides getting vaccinated after your prior infection, we do recommend masking, distancing, the layered prevention that we've been talking about for a while to keep folks safe. One person asked about this idea of combined Delta and Omicron infection. So what you might have seen in some early news stories of what people call Deltacron, which sounds very scary, not a real thing. There were about, I think, 20 cases that were diagnosed in one lab in the world. And it was actually just lab contamination of the equipment. So you can't get Delta and Omicron at the same time. You can imagine when you run samples on equipment, if it gets a little dirty with the prior samples and then you run another set, that's how you end up with both viruses showing up in the same sample. But we are not seeing that as a possibility right now. What you can get is a reinfection. So you had Delta, you recovered, and then you get Omicron. Otherwise, we got a question about the format of the daily department health updates. They asked what the population considered South County is. So South County is, let me get the exact zip codes that's covered in South County. That's the zip codes 98376 and 98320, basically Quilting and Brennan. That's South County. Sounds like we have some unstable internet at the courthouse, so we've lost the video on two of our commissioners, but they're still here. So that's how you can kind of assess those numbers as you're talking about Quilcene and Brennan there. This next question, I think, was an interesting one to dive into. This person said, as we look to future variants, is the medical community looking at how to handle these loads in a way that would, for example, limit for any hospital how many ICU beds might be assigned to those who are unvaccinated by choice or personal belief? Is there any consideration to limit medical access of some services for the unvaccinated? With the strain and risk for medical staff, many leaving the profession, and delays in denial of services for others, it seems to be a discussion point worth having. So I think this is an important question to talk about. It's a question I've heard a little bit. And I would say that the idea of denial of services for people who have chosen not to be vaccinated is one that has come up in ethics discussions about hospital utilization, but it is one that we have kind of all decided as a medical community that we're not going to do. And there are a couple reasons for that. I think this question brings up a very valid concern, which is that we are all connected. It just highlights the fact that we are connected. What feels like a personal choice is not really. It affects the people around you. So when our hospital system gets overwhelmed by people getting treated for COVID-19 who are predominantly unvaccinated, and that affects the people around you. That affects their access to care. I know in many families, it's affected access to surgical care. So you've got people who need surgeries who can't get it. And that does affect the entire community. What we generally do in the health system is when it comes to limiting care, when there's not enough care around and we have to decide who gets it, we make those decisions based on who is most likely to survive. So it's based on a triage system. We don't make decisions based on kind of a test of the morality of how you got there. So you can imagine we don't want to do that with COVID-19 vaccines. And you can imagine why we don't want to do it in other spaces too. We don't want doctors and nurses saying, well, you don't deserve to be here because you got here because you were drinking too much, you know, or you got here because you weren't wearing a seatbelt. That's just not something we do. As soon as you come through our doors and you need care, we provide you care. We don't care how you got there. We care how sick you are, and we do everything we can to get you better. That's a decision we've made as a health system, and we continue to make that decision. So I want folks who are unvaccinated to know that too, that we really, really want you to get vaccinated because we want you to survive. We don't want you to have prolonged disability, and we want the system to function for everyone. But if you get sick enough that you need that care, we're happy to take care of you. That's why we're here. And we don't judge how you got here. We just want you to survive. But I do want to acknowledge the frustration of many in our community who want to move on with their lives. And it's frustrating to still be here, knowing that we have good treatments available, we have good prevention measures available. But and there's kind of a desire to decouple ourselves, that we've learned that we're not islands, and we'd like to go be islands, but we can't. We are a community. We share our resources. We share our hospital. We share our water. We are connected, and our decisions affect each other. And there's no ethical way to split that. So we'll still take care of you. Come on in, but do get vaccinated. It will make all the difference to putting this behind us and in your health and ability to survive this virus if you get infected. Next question. Someone said, yesterday I spotted this post on social media. Basically, it was a person who said some nasty things about the idea that our numbers are really high, and it must be that our measures aren't working. And this person asked, how would you recommend responding to it? And I would say, first thing is, don't. Don't feed the trolls. It's never a good idea. If you see someone posting something on social media that looks inflammatory, that looks, you know, out of whack, my best advice is don't engage. It never leads anywhere good. And generally, sometimes that's actually what they want you to do. But it is good to know the numbers for your own awareness. So one of the best ways to understand that is around our cumulative death rates in the pandemic. So in the United States, we have lost 256 people per 100,000. So it's a population-based kind of per capita metric. That's the average in the United States. Washington State has one of the lowest rates of death due to COVID-19 in all of the United States.
I can't open
it. You can't open it? You want me to help you? Okay. So in Washington State, our death rate is quite a bit lower. It's 133, so approximately half of the death rate in the United States. In Jefferson County, our death rate is half of that, so it's 72. We have one of the lowest death rates in all of the United States due to COVID-19, and that's because of the work we've done here. It's because of the mitigation measures that we've put in place. It's because of the work of our citizenry to follow those mitigation measures. So we have done dramatically better than the rest of the country. And that's because of all of this work. Because of our age, we would have been on track to do quite a bit worse because we are an older county. But we haven't done that because of all the work that all of the people listening have done to keep everybody safe. So it's made a difference. What sometimes you'll see is people will compare different parts of the country that are at different phases in their wave. Sometimes they do that because they don't understand the data. Sometimes they do that intentionally and try to mislead people about the data. But the numbers don't lie. We have lost quite a few less people in our community than in nearly any other community in the United States. Clallam County, which has had worse cases than Jefferson in recent months, actually still has a lower rate than Washington State as a whole. We've lost 125 of our citizens per 100,000. Yeah, I'll get that. So it has worked. It makes a difference. Many of our fellow citizens are alive now because of that work. And if you are doing that hard work and you're getting frustrated because other people aren't, know that it's making a difference for yourself and for your community. And so you can just quietly know that they are healthy and alive because of the good work that you're doing, and then don't engage on social media. All right. One person asks, a grocery store they shop at does not require employees to be vaccinated. And we have learned that one of the people who works in the produce department is not vaccinated. Is his handling produce putting us as a shopper at any risk? No. Actually, there is a risk if you have folks who are unvaccinated indoors, because there is the possibility that they have COVID. There is a possibility that those who are vaccinated have COVID too. It's just that that risk is much higher if you're unvaccinated. But we are not seeing spread due to contact. So back in the early days of COVID, we were doing a lot of cleaning of surfaces, if you remember. That was before we learned how COVID was spread. And it's really spread in the air. And so having someone touch your produce is not a risk for you. We still recommend rinsing off your produce when you come home for a variety of health and safety reasons. And of course, wearing a good mask when you go to the grocery store. So KN95, a KF94, or an N95 if it fits on you, or if none of those feel good or fit you well, a surgical mask with a cloth mask over it that fits it well to your face, all will provide you good protection. And of course, getting vaccinated and boosted yourself. And along that line, someone asked, how do you, you want me to start that one? Okay. Why did it break? We're feeling crayons. So this person asked, how do you pick a good mask? How do you know if you have an authentic mask? And that is a challenge. There's a lot of fakes out there. So couple things you can do. Where's the top for it? I don't know, buddy. Mama's on her meeting. We gotta be a little quiet, okay? Here you go. So if it's an N95, those are actually NIOSH approved. So you can look and see if it's got a NIOSH approval on it. Another option is to get a KF94. So KF94 is the Korean model, which is roughly equivalent to a KN95. They're made in South Korea. And there are very few fakes of KF94s. So that's a good option. Many people find they are a little more comfortable than a KN95. And they, you can look to see if they're made in South Korea. They're regulated by the Korean government. Oh, I think Yogi ate your cheese, bud. We'll get you some more as soon as we're done with the meeting, I promise. So if it's made in South Korea, it's likely to be reputable. If it's made anywhere else, it's likely not. And then a KN95, there are a couple numbers you can look for to see if they're stamped on the package or on the mask. We can do a post about this on Facebook to tell you a lot more details about it. But it's the GB2626-2006 or -2019. Or you can get it from a reputable source. So Project N95 or Bonafide Masks or Well Before are all very reasonable places to find your KN95s. Be really cautious with Amazon. There's a lot of fakes on Amazon. So that's a couple of basics of how to find a good mask. But remember, the most important thing is that it fits you well and that you'll keep it on. So try a couple, see what works for you. Some people find a KN95 feels better. Some people find a KF94 feels better. Some people can hold an N95 on. Just try it on and make sure you've got one that fits you well that you won't take off before you go out into a place where you need it. And we are rapidly losing our toddler friend.
Dr. Berry, I just want you to know, I do have a written report from Willie from Friday, which I could share.
Perfect.
Go whenever you need to, but I'm happy to talk about
that. What he wanted to have shared today. So if we do end up going, then I'll tag in Kate to speak for Willie's presentation. All right, couple other things. So someone asked about the data around COVID-19 hospitalizations. If a patient was the recipient of two mRNA vaccines but not boosted compared to a patient who is unvaccinated, and if there's any data we could share there. So yes, actually the Washington State Department of Health posts data every week about the risk of hospitalization and death and the risk of contracting COVID dependent on your vaccine status. And they actually don't include boosters there. It's only if you've received either two mRNA doses or a J&J, or if you are unvaccinated. That's the only people they compare there. There was some common misconception that that includes boosters. It actually does not. So we actually post that on our Facebook updates every week. And depending on your age, you are 5 to 9 times more likely to get hospitalized if you are unvaccinated compared to if you are fully vaccinated, even if you haven't had a booster. If you've had your booster, that dramatically drops to actually 60 times less likely to get hospitalized compared to someone who's unvaccinated. It's really, really unlikely if you get your booster, which is part of why it's so important to get that booster to reduce your risk of getting hospitalized and your risk of spreading that infection to others. You trying to pull the blanket over? You can do it. Here you go. Okay. A couple other things. One person asked about kind of the restaurant order lifting and actually asked if I could wait a little longer to lift it. And so that's a little bit along the lines of what we were talking about. I think it will be, it's such a challenge as a community because there are some folks who want us to have never written that order. And then there are other folks who really don't want that order to go away. And we all have to figure out how to navigate this together as a community because we can't decouple our community. I do think that if we get our case rates down below 200 cases per 100,000, it will be safe to revoke that order. The reason is a matter of probability. So when your case rates are low, the probability that anyone in that space has COVID is also low, even if they're unvaccinated. So if you have a very low risk, even if your neighbor who's unvaccinated is 5 times as likely to be infected as you, their risk is still low if we have low community prevalence. And so your probability of picking up COVID-19 in those spaces is lower. But again, some of our restaurants may choose to keep that order in place, and that could be a good option for folks who want to go to a place that has that order in place. Or if you don't feel safe yet going out to a restaurant, that's okay. You can eat outside, you can get some takeout. We all have to manage our own personal risk and adjust based on what makes us most comfortable. This person did ask about the masking requirements, so that we are planning on maintaining the masking requirements. The threshold for removing masking is lower than the threshold for removing proof of vaccination. Primary reason is masking is something we all can do. It has no economic negative, and we want to be cautious that we don't bring about a significant unnecessary wave by revoking masking too soon. If you actually follow the history of the flu pandemic of 1918, it actually wasn't just 1918, it was a 3-year pandemic. And so when we're looking at the COVID-19 pandemic and thinking about the fact that we're getting into the third year, that is actually anticipated. That is how the flu pandemic went too. And in cities that removed their masking orders too soon, they had significant and devastating waves. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to be masking forever, but we do want to wait until it's safe to revoke the masking order. So that'll be a little later. We're working on defining the metrics for that right now. All right. One person asked about the statistics on the total population vaccinated and if that includes small children who are not yet eligible to be vaccinated, and it does. So when we talk about total population, we mean everybody, because kids can spread COVID too. And so knowing our overall population that's vaccinated matters. So in Jefferson County, 75% of our population, including little kids, are fully vaccinated. If we make that just the population 5 and up who are eligible for vaccination, 78% of us are fully vaccinated. Interestingly, only 51% of us have received a booster. So we do still have a little ways to go to get the rest of our population boosted. We do really want to encourage folks to get that booster. The folks we're missing mostly is our young folks who are not getting boosted, which I understand. Your probability of getting hospitalized and dying from COVID is pretty low. So you might think, why get a booster? And the biggest reason to get a booster is so you don't give COVID to somebody else who could get hospitalized. So do go get that booster. It's very safe. I've had mine. It's a really important thing to protect the rest of your community. All right. This next one was a little bit of a research project, but I think was an interesting evaluation of the data to do. So this person asked, could you please contrast Omicron to the seasonal flu with respect to likelihood of hospitalization, especially for those over 65, and likelihood of death, especially for those over 65, as well as the length of recuperation? So we kind of did a quick intro to this at the beginning of the meeting today, but I do think it's important to wade into because it has become a common talking point that we shouldn't worry about COVID because it's basically the flu. And that's not true. And the mortality numbers really speak for themselves. Every year, about 20 to 50,000 Americans die due to the flu before the COVID-19 pandemic. In the last year alone, we lost 460,000 Americans to COVID-19. So it's just dramatically worse. The mortality, the case fatality due to influenza is roughly about 0.1 on any given year, varies year to year, depending on the severity of the strains. The mortality due to the Omicron variant in the unvaccinated is 1.2%, which doesn't sound like much. It sounds like if you roll the dice on that, you know, you'll probably be fine. But the challenge is if you do that on a population level, if you just look at 1.2% of Jefferson County, that's a whole lot of people that would die due to COVID-19 if we let it just run rampant. So the mortality rate due to COVID-19 in the unvaccinated, even with Omicron, is 12 times that of the flu. And that's in the general population. In people over 65, it's 8 times that. So if you got COVID-19, you're unvaccinated and you're over 65, your mortality rate is roughly 10%. 1 in 10 people over 65 who contract COVID-19, if they're not vaccinated, will die of it. That's how severe this virus is. And so when you look at the fact that so many of our population in Jefferson County is over 65, that would be crushing if that happened. The good news is that if you are vaccinated, your risk of death due to COVID-19, not even boosted, just regular old vaccinated, is 1/9 of that. And so if you divide 10% by 9, you can realize you get really close to around 1%. So you can get this back towards the risk that you would see with influenza. We see similar patterns when it comes to hospitalization, though the difference is not as stark, because we actually have really high in-hospital mortality due to COVID-19. And that's something that if you talk to any doctors or nurses who have been working in the hospital, is one of the things that is so painful about COVID-19. In the American hospital system, we are not used to losing our patients. Generally, when they get hospitalized, we can fix them and they go home. That is not true with COVID-19. If you get hospitalized with COVID-19, 16% of those who get hospitalized will die. We are not used to losing that percentage of our patients every time they come in. And that rate is even higher if you're over 65. So long story short, you can think of COVID-19 in general, even the Omicron variant, as about 12 times worse than the flu for the general population. But if you get vaccinated, it's 1/9 of that. So it's still worse than the flu, but it's close. And that's the biggest thing that you can do to make COVID-19 feel more and more like the flu, both for yourself and for the community. If we want to move on and move forward with our lives and not have to worry about COVID-19 anymore, I certainly do. The way that we do that is we get vaccinated. Okay, just a couple more, and then I'll pass it to Kate to do Willie Benz's update so I can attend to my tiny friend. Regarding booster shots, will a second booster of either Pfizer or Moderna be advised or available in the future? I would say at this point, we aren't yet recommending a second booster. The reason for that is the boosters are still holding up incredibly well at preventing hospitalization and death, and they're still holding up pretty well at preventing any infection at all. We also expect our case rates, as we've discussed at the beginning of this call, to drop dramatically in the coming months. And so it's not clear that we will need a booster. Time will tell on whether or not we will need a booster. If we do, it will likely be more like a seasonal booster, where every fall, for example, we'll recommend a booster of the COVID-19 vaccine, kind of like we do with the flu. But we don't know yet. Many of our vaccines that we use right now are 3-dose vaccines, and then you're done and you don't need it anymore. And we don't know which one it'll be. It could be a 3-dose vaccine and then out, or it could be something that we repeat annually. The only exception to that is if you are immunosuppressed. So there is a subset of the population, about 8,600 people on the Olympic Peninsula, who got an early 3rd dose because they are immunosuppressed. Folks who are transplant patients, who are on immunosuppressing medications, who have genetic immunodeficiencies, those folks do need 4 doses. And you can imagine why. Their immune system is not as capable of responding to the vaccine. So those folks do need a 4th dose 5 months after their last vaccine. Many of those folks just became eligible to do so. If you're in that group, go ahead and get your 4th dose as soon as you can. You can talk to your provider about whether or not you're in that group. But if you're not immunosuppressed, 3 doses is what we are sticking with right now. Any other questions from the team before I log off? Okay. Thank you guys. I appreciate your understanding, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Dr. Berry and Tiny Friend.